Hannah French.
Hello, yes, welcome to the Early Music Show, the home of music pre-Mozart here on BBC Radio 3. Today we're continuing our mini-series exploring the Olympic medals and their connections to early music. Second up, silver. So stand by for an epic journey from the silver mines of South America to sacred silver cups, 30 pieces of silver, and of course, silver trumpets. Sound the Trumpet from Henry Purcell's Come Ye Sons of Art. Andrea Scholl and Christophe Dumeau taking up the fanfares with Accademia Byzantina, directed by Stefano Montanari. A more brass of the silver variety a little later. But let's start this silver-themed show with an actual silver medal. Not a modern Olympic one, but a beautiful specimen from 1603, fashioned by the French sculptor and medalist Guillaume Dupré, and on display at the V&A Museum in South Kensington in London. On one side, the medal depicts the busts of Henry IV of France and his wife, Maria de' Medici. And on the reverse, the pair are shown as Mars and Minerva, with a young dauphin in tow. Now, the symbolism here is key. Minerva was the Roman goddess of wisdom, the arts and peace, capable of defeating the destructive power of war, symbolised by Mars, one of the 12 Olympians. Maria de' Medici was indeed a great patron of the arts, and on her marriage to Henri, Jacopo Peri dedicated to her his opera Euridice.
Minacci il volto, femmina, pietà.
Music from the prologue to Jacopo Peri's opera Euridice. These are the sounds that transport us back to the wedding of Maria de' Medici to Henry IV of France in Florence in 1600. However, Peri should not take all the glory here, even in dedicating this opera to Maria, because the actual performance also featured numerous airs and choruses by Giulio Caccini. Peri and Caccini were rivals, and after the wedding raced to publish their respective settings of Euridice. Technically, Caccini won. His came out a few weeks before Peri's was printed. But in reality, he took second place because it wasn't performed for nearly 2 years. In the ears of contemporary audiences, Peri enjoyed a far greater victory. And he's gone down in the opera history books as the composer of the first ever opera, his lost opera Daphne, that came before this. A case of first the worst, second the best? If Caccini took silver medal, his score is certainly a winner in the 21st century, even, and I'd say especially, when he's throwing shade.
Funeste piagge, ombrosi orridi tanti, che di stelle di sole non vedeste giammai scintille lampi. Rimbombate dolenti al suon dell'angoscia. Con questi accenti il perduto mio ben con voi sospiro e voi te per pietà del mio martiro che nel misero cor di restai fra pianto e duo, come angue suole in fredda piaggia il verno. Lagrimate al mio pianto, ombre d'inferno. Il ciel piacque luce di questi luni fatti al tuo dipartire fontane e fiumi che fai per entro i tenebrosi orrori forse t'affligge piani l'acerbo fatto gli infelici amori se scintilla ancora ti scalpa il seno di quei sicari ardori senti mia vita senti quei pianti e quei lamenti verso il tuo caro Orfeo dal cuore in ombre
shady, horrid fields from Act 1, Scene 4 of Caccini's version of Euridice. Rinaldo Alessandrini directed Concerto Italiano. Despite his luck at the printers, Caccini essentially took second place to Peri, a sparkling silver, in their race to set Ottavio Rinuccini's libretto, based on the tale of Orpheus and Euridice from Ovid's Metamorphoses. For the happy occasion of the wedding, Rinuccini changed the tale's ending so that everyone lived. But Ovid's original is more nuanced. John Dryden's translation reads, "But when good Saturn, banished from above, was driven to hell, the world was under Jove. Succeeding times, a silver age behold, excelling brass, but more excelled by gold." Let me take you on a whistle-stop tour of various silver ages next here on BBC Radio 3. We'll start by jumping aboard an ancient Phoenician ship in around 750 BC, loaded with so much Spanish silver, they had to fashion anchors from it in place of lead just to get it all home. For the ancient Greeks, silver coins were the staple currency. Later, the Romans would extract tens of thousands of tons of silver, mostly from Spain, to keep their enormous economy buoyant. By the Middle Ages, Central Europe was the centre of silver production. And then, just as it looked like the mines were becoming exhausted, came the discovery of America. Peru, Bolivia, Chile, all were rich in silver deposits, and Argentina's even named after the metal which brought its wealth. New World mines supported the Spanish Empire, but conquistadors weren't just after silver. Their Jesuit missionaries sought to convert South America's indigenous peoples to Christianity, and one of those missionaries was a composer called Domenico Zippoli.
Para, 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 para.
Domenico Zippoli, writing for organ, a piece from the Bolivian archives recorded by James Johnston in the Mission Church of Santa Ana de Velasco on a restored 18th century blockwork organ. Before it, we heard the traditional Bolivian Naranjitai Juanyo, sung by the Aracanda Bolivia Choir, directed by Ashley Solomon. And to begin, Zippoli's Chapie Zui Chupa, performed by Seconda Pratica, Christian words translated into the Chiquito language as a tool to help convert indigenous peoples of South America to Christianity in the 18th century. Back home, Spain had long boasted the spoils of importing vast quantities of silver from Central and South America, but the royal government was frequently in or close to bankruptcy. Their crusades cost more than they brought in, and the plundering did nothing to foster a productive work ethic. But their craftspeople certainly knew how to show it off at its best. Take Seville Cathedral, cavernous and startling in its lavish grandeur, having benefited from the first wave of imported precious metal. The main chapel altarpiece is coated with gold and thought to be the largest in the world. It has to be seen to be believed. But silver is there too, an enormous silver altar designed to resemble an immense monstrance, the Catholic ceremonial vessel that holds the consecrated host, the body of Christ. Now here's music that would have floated through Seville Cathedral in the first decades of the 17th century, when Alonso Lobo was in charge of the choir. Martin Baker conducted the choir of Westminster Cathedral in the opening of Alonso Lobo's Lamentations of Jeremiah. music sung before an altar of silver in Seville. But the prophet Jeremiah was well aware of the metal's properties and value when he wrote, "Silver spread into plates is brought from Tarshish, the work of cunning men." It hints at the fact that in the Bible, the connotations of silver are far from positive. Reprobate silver, 30 pieces of silver. These days, that's a phrase used to describe a price at which people sell out. But it has a long history of betrayal and was famously the reward paid to Judas Iscariot for turning Jesus in. We hear that transactional moment in Johann Sebastian Bach's St. Matthew Passion. And in this recording with the group Pygmalion, you can hear Judas pocketing the cash, the harpsichord jangling the 30 pieces of silver into his purse.
Tagen hin der Zwölfen einer, mit Namen Judas Iskariot, zu den hohen Priestern und sprach:
Was wollt ihr mir geben? Ich will ihn euch verraten.
Und sie boten ihm 30 Silberlinge. Und von dem an suchte er Gelegenheit, dass er ihn verriete.
Oh,
Bleed now, loving heart, for your child has become a serpent. Threats of murder in Johann Sebastian Bach's Blüte nur from his St. Matthew Passion. Hanna Blazikova was the soprano soloist, Julien Prégardien the evangelist, and Georg Finger, Judas Iscariot, in that recording with Pygmalion, conducted by Raphael Pichon. No good comes from the 30 pieces of silver used to buy Judas's betrayal. He throws it back into the temple, and the elders use the money to buy a potter's field, in which Judas then hangs himself. Second place silver proves a slippery customer, perhaps surprisingly, a symbol of greed and perverted values in this week's medal-themed early music show, the second of three with me, Hannah French, on BBC Radio 3. And before silver can shine out today, I've one more tale of betrayal, but there's redemption in it too. It's the biblical story of Joseph, yes, of Technicolor Dreamcoat fame, but here with his brethren in an oratorio by Handel. Well, the crucial moment is in both. In a test of integrity, Joseph plants a silver cup. Sorry, Rice and Lloyd Webber, it wasn't gold. In his youngest brother Benjamin's sack of grain. It's possible we're talking here of a silver divination cup, a precious object commonly owned by Egyptian nobility, and one that in itself would strike fear into his brothers' hearts. Well, it ends well. Joseph's test works. He eventually reveals his identity to the brothers who once betrayed him and sold him into slavery. Now, that silvery connotation, those fearful thoughts of betrayal, they're wound into Handel's music. Joseph's wife, Asenath, sings The Silver Stream, an aria that reflects on her husband's troubled mind when setting the trap for his brothers.
Yeah.
Arseneth's aria The Silver Stream from Handel's Joseph and His Brothers, sung by soprano Scheherazade Panthaki. Nicholas McGeegan conducted the Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra. Well, while we're in Egypt with Joseph's silver divination cup, we might just side-glance some other silver objects. Ancient Egyptians thought that playing flutes with silver mouthpieces could ward off evil spirits, the metal itself carrying inexplicable powers. And though it couldn't be explained as such then, silver does have antimicrobial properties, which are now known to protect wind instruments from saliva-caused bacteria and contamination. But the use of silver in instruments really comes to the fore when we meet the martial brass and percussion. David Munro directed the Early Music Consort of London in the Pavane La Bataille from Tilman Susato's 1551 suite, The Danseries. Early cymbals crash there, but their story leaps forward in the early 17th century with the innovations of Avedis Zildjian, an Armenian metalsmith and alchemist at the court of the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire in Constantinople. Recognising its specific malleable properties, Zildjian combined silver with tin and copper to make sheets of alloy that could make significant musical sounds without shattering. And the Zildjian Company are still making cymbals that grace drum kits the world over today. Quite the legacy. As for brass instruments, well, the name evokes the burnished colour of the instruments themselves, but throughout the Middle Ages, there are examples of silver as well as brass trumpets and trombones. But for this, we have to rely on written descriptions because, as expert Timothy McGee points out, iconography and manuscripts can be ambiguous and unreliable, especially if conscientious restorers over the years touch up the damaged images with the colour they think that the original might have been. The thing is, silver decays after 100 years or so, is often completely disappeared from a painting or otherwise turned black. From the late 15th century, the city of Nuremberg was a centre of brass instrument making, and a good number of records specify silver in the commissions. For example, a silver trombone for Pope Leo X and 24 silver trumpets for the King of Poland. Samuel Scheidt's Galliard Battaglia, played by His Majesty's Sackbuts and Cornets. Not necessarily on silver instruments, but this was the sort of repertoire in which they would have shone. And not just because silver looks elegant, but as heat conducts so well through it, it makes for a vibrant, defined tone, ideal for outdoor performances. An instrument not at all suitable for outdoor pursuits was the flute. Nor was it generally made of silver until the 19th century, but silver was used for innovation in the 18th century. Johann Joachim Kvantz was flute teacher and flute maker for the flute-playing King Frederick the Great. 8 of the monarch's instruments survive, 4 of them made from ebony with 2 silver keys. Now, 1 key was usual at the time, but among Kvantz's various flute-improving innovations was a second hole and key at the bottom of the instrument so that you could play E-flat and D-sharp as 2 different notes. It enabled the flautist to play better in tune generally and in more keys too. The 19th century saw far greater innovation, famously with the system developed by Theobald Böhm, pushing Kvantz's idea back into second place. But for that moment, and for King Frederick, a sonata in E-flat major was a dream.
Thank you.
Rachel Brown, the flautist, accompanied by James Johnston and Mark Caudle in the Flute Sonata in E-flat Major by Johann Joachim Kvantz. Rachel playing on a Kvantz flute with his invention of two silver keys. Well, we'll never know the extent to which Kvantz was truly impressed by King Frederick the Great's flute playing, but if he were handing out medals, Frederick would certainly have been awarded gold over the slippery silver technique of a certain Jacques de Vaucanson. In 1737, the French inventor, famed for mimicking biological functions such as circulation, respiration and digestion in his automata and androids, presented the flute player. The sophisticated, life-size figure of a shepherd reportedly played, lungs, lips, fingers and all, 12 songs on the pipe and tabor. Kvantz was not impressed. He claimed Vaucanson misled potential flautists with false and harmful advice on flute playing technique and breathing. Automatons were all the rage, though, in the mid-18th century, and another ingenious mechanic who specialised in musical machines was Belgian Jean-Joseph Merlin. He's credited with constructing a 6-octave piano 15 years before Broadwood got in on the action, and apparently once decimated an extremely valuable mirror, crashing into it while playing the violin on his latest invention, inline roller skates. His 18th century self-propelling wheelchair caught my eye, but what has all this to do with silver? Our silver odyssey ends today with Merlin's collaboration with British jeweller James Cox on an automaton of a silver swan. Redeeming the metal to full glory, American novelist Mark Twain wrote that said swan had a living grace about his movement and a living intelligence in its eyes. You can judge for yourself as it preens itself and catches a silver fish at the Bowes Museum in Barnard Castle. It calls out for us to finally bestow upon this silver early music show a piece I reckon some of you would have waited about an hour to hear by now. Orlando Gibbons, The Silver Swan.
Thank you. Apollo 5 singing The Silver Swan by Orlando Gibbons, rounding off the early music show today. Hannah French will be back, this time with a gold-themed edition, in a fortnight, on Sunday the 11th of August, at the earlier time of 6 o'clock.
BBC Radio 3, the home of classical music.
Listening to classical music in the morning just allows you some space to ready yourself for the day.
We live in a time in which the things that musicians are doing have never been more viscerally thrilling.
If you can tell when they have star quality, there is nothing like it.
BBC Radio 3, the home of classical music.
It's like breathing. I couldn't think of a day, an hour maybe, where I'm not thinking something musical.
Listen on your radio, on your smart speaker, and on BBC Sounds.
BBC Radio 3, it's 7:30, and time to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for the second of today's proms. It's presented by Katie Derham.
Thank you so much. Yes, welcome to the proms and the Royal Albert Hall. We are going to be dialing down the lights and raising the temperature to sultry for a celebration of the divine Sarah Vaughan in her centenary year. One of the great jazz voices of the 20th century. And yet, as we will learn, so much more than that. She could sing anything, it seemed. And over the course of 40 years or so, she pretty much did. From blues and bossa to ballads and bebop. She had a range which swooped with inimitable colour and control from soprano down to baritone. And she worked with the likes of Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, Miles Davis, Tom Jobim, Michael Tilson Thomas. And indeed, she started her career opening for Ella Fitzgerald. Well, to tell her story, the BBC Concert Orchestra this evening is joined by the brilliant Guy Barker, composer, conductor, arranger, trumpeter, and he has curated an evening of music closely associated with Sarah Vaughan, with hits including Misty, Tenderly, Black Coffee, and Lullaby of Birdland. To perform them, we have four singers standing by. They have the honour and the challenge. There are phenomenal up-and-coming talent in the shape of Charisse and Lucianne Daniels. We've got the jazz and gospel legend Liz Wright. They're going to be joined by the powerhouses of musical theatre, Marisha Wallace and Clark Peters, who will also be presenting from the stage. That applause you're hearing now is for Charles Mutter, who's the leader of the BBC Concert Orchestra this evening. The orchestra is set out in quite an interesting way. If you imagine where the conductor's podium is, you've got his big band, the Guy Barker big band on one side, and the concert orchestra to the left. But that applause is for Guy Barker. Coming onto the stage now to conduct the BBC Concert Orchestra in this special tribute to Sarah Vaughan.